Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Follow Your Path. My name is Abdul Abid. I'm a surgical pathology fellow at University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And today, we will be talking to Dr. Ankur Sangoi. He is in community practice in the Bay Area, and he focuses primarily on GU pathology. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sangoi.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So starting off, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to medical school and did your residency?
Sure. So I grew up in Kansas City, on the Kansas side. So I'm sort of a Rock Chalk Jayhawk fan by definition. And did medical school and undergraduate at St. Louis University, followed by pathology training. I left the Midwest and went out west to join Stanford, and did an interesting thing. I did APCP at Stanford for 4 years. I did not do a fellowship. That's kind of an unusual thing nowadays, but the Stanford had, and I think they still currently do, have a lot of flexibility with the their block scheduling. So essentially, all my elective and essentially most of my CP training, to be honest with you, I pretty much stayed in AP. Probably should have done a little more CP than I needed. I wouldn't recommend that, but I pretty much just did a makeshift fellowship in GU and Surge Path basically throughout those last 2 years. So I kind of milked Stanford for all it had worth. Unusual. And actually was slotted to do the Surge Path Fellowship formally right afterwards. And I got a call from the local, you know, kind of a pseudo academic group where I'm at now with the cancer center and everything. And I got the call for the job. And, you know, the whole goal is obviously of training is to get a good quality job. And so when that came, it was a little hard to pass up. Doing another formal fellowship, but I think, you know, I'd kind of milked Stanford for what it had worth. It was a little interesting at Stanford. So at the time they were general, they had no subspecialty training. They have they are now formally subspecialized, but they had no subspecialty training. So there was no cytology and the board certified ones, but there was no GI, GU, anything. So I essentially started on my own during my 6 months of elective during the CP formally, a kind of a GU subspecialty where I, you know, pulled cases myself. I took all the GU consult cases, all the outside inside reviews, all the inside cases I kind of pulled by hand, manually re-reviewed those before they went to hot seat. So I did my own GU fellowship training, sort of made one on my own, but there was nothing then.
Oh, wow. So how did you get interested in GU pathology? Was there a particular mentor that kind of inspired you towards it?
Yeah, so it was interesting. So I actually started out I still have an interest in GYN. Stanford is very, very strong in GYN historically. So you're exposed to a lot of good cases. And Terry Longacre at Stanford was actually probably my first mentors. And my understanding of research, I've done quite a bit now during training, and I've continued to do it here in private practice, which is a little challenging to do. But, you know, for me, that's the best way to sort of stay up to date. But I was under the impression I had really no research background in med school. So I thought, you know, pathology research was like pipetting, bench work and stuff like that. And, once I started training, I was like, wow, there's actually a lot of clinical, cases and things you can do. And she basically was like, hey, we have this interesting project, here's two papers or here's two studies, go do them. That's what she did. And, reviewed all the slides. And, she was awesome. She really kind of helped me write the paper up. And she probably, did a lot more work than probably I deserved at the time and helped me get, two AJSPs, right in training. And I was like, wow, this is research. This is cool. So that was actually, I started out in GYN and, maintained that, but GU kind of came along the way. I realized, that's kind of an area I had to, in kidney tumors, I had a real interest in that. And then when Jesse McKinney, joined Stanford, probably halfway through my training, I, sort of paired up with him and he's, became a mentor, still is a mentor and, obviously now a friend, essentially did the GU subspecialty, training, pseudo subspecialty, so to speak. There was nothing formal, under him. So that's sort of, started out with GYN and sort of, put on another hat in GU.
Oh, well. So if you had to tell a medical student or an incoming resident as to why GU pathology is a unique specialty, what would you tell them?
It's a little interesting in the fact that there are overlaps among, kidney, bladder, prostate, testis and, penile pathology as well, sometimes urethra stuff. But they're very... I felt like you could actually master each individual, actually similar to GYN. It's, they're sort of, they're discrete organ categories versus compared to, I think, you know, GI, which is spread over like a billion organs, it feels like. And then there's like a lot of medical aspect to it. And I mean, not that there's not medical, obviously, in bladder and in prostate, there's definitely a medical side to it, but it's more, you know, cancer, non-cancer, and mimics. It's easier to grasp, I would say, to me at least, you know, to start out and go learn medical lung. It was a little hard. But I think, you know, it's less quote unquote medical, so to speak, but for me at least, it was very discreet, like, you know, okay, it was sort of line item, very easily outlinable. Very difficult to outline. I think that, you know, medical liver people probably can say the same thing. You definitely could outline things, it's definitely approachable.
I completely agree with that. So in GU pathology, you have been practicing for a few years. Has there been a case, a particularly interesting case that is memorable for you that has stayed on with you all those years?
There's too many cases. Except we see, in my practice, you know, here we see a fair amount of GU, and even in community practice, we're a little unusual in our group here that we're actually subspecialized. That, you know, most of the GU cases that come through, you know, come to me, they're assigned to me, and then, you know, leftover stuff, you know, I do, you know, other general search paths. So it's kind of a mix. Probably no specific case, but the way I kind of go about is, you know, I had an adult, actually maybe 30 some odd year old lady a couple of years ago, presenting with a really unusual, you know, kidney tumor. I couldn't, you know, sort of pin it out, and ended up being an ALK, mutated RCC, in an adult without sickle cell, which is, you know, kind of unusual on that aspect too. So I essentially, you know, pulled some cases and wrote it up. And that's kind of the way I've sort of done research over the past 10, almost 15 years now. It's all by interesting cases. You know, there's a case, literally a live case, comes across. It's like, hey, this would be cool to look at, or I wonder how many blank, 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 blank. It's sort of more practical, hands-on approach, and then sort of, you know, spins off. A research project. And so, you know, in prostate, I've done that, in kidney, I've done that, in bladder, I've done that, kind of similar things.
Oh, wow. If you had to say, what is the most enjoyable part of your job that you do right now?
Currently, it's, that's a good question. Probably the fact that I'm able to tie in a lot of my research interest in clinical things and the things that are sort of cutting edge. I think that's sort of broad spectrum that you probably applicable to all pathology, but in kind of going back to your other question about GU, and I always kind of, you know, joke with my family and friends and everything, is pathology is such an evolving sort of field. It's like literally something I diagnosed 6 months ago, I probably would call something different now. It's that different, you know, let alone even years back, but sort of a constantly evolving kind of thing. So, I mean, every case that comes across my desk, you know, it's I have to stay up to date, but sort of forces me to stay up to date. But that's the sort of the thing I really like about it, especially in GU, you know, with the kidney tumors are sort of, you know, largely evolving. The sort of constant updating and sort of, at least for me, sort of tying back into research.
Nice. So if someone, I know you did not do a fellowship, but if a resident wants to do a fellowship in GU, do you have any rough idea of like places that have GU, like how many places have GU fellowships?
And yeah, are there any? There's quite a few. There's sort of the laundry. Even Stanford is going to be having one, has one already. There, it's definitely growing. It's, you know, obviously it's not, you know, I think boardsable, so to speak.
Right.
Like, you know, cytology and a few of the other ones, HemePath. But the thing I would say is similar to me. I don't think you have to have a fellowship. If you're at an institution that has a lot of good material and good faculty, you don't have to necessarily do a subspecialty. I never did a formal subspecialty. And, you know, I think most people, when I tell people that, they're sort of like, you know, wait, what? How is that possible? But, you know, just given my publication history and everything. But that, you know, you can make your own, you know, fellowship anywhere with the right material and the right faculty. There are several places, but sort of the interesting thing, at least amongst GU fellowship wise, there's only a handful of places that sort of tie in medical renal with GU. So if you have an interest in that, or at least be aware of, if you absolutely do not have an interest in that, there are some places that tie in. It's a little challenging, in my opinion, to sort of tie that in. I think it definitely could be done. I mean, you're looking at a kidney. I feel sort of idiotic sometimes, sort of, you know, looking at the background kidney. I'm like, well, how does it assess? In terms of, there's a lot of obviously medical aspects. So I think there are a handful of programs, probably less than five, that actually do formal kidney, or at least, you know, a couple of rotations in. I think that's great if you can tie that in, but that's probably far and few between, because I think you probably need a whole year for that. But yeah, there's a quite a few GU places, and I think most are one, some are 2 year.
If someone, a trainee, including a fourth year medical student or incoming resident, if they're interested in GU pathology, would you recommend any resources for them to read, societies to join, stuff that they can learn before they apply for a fellowship?
I would definitely get involved with the GUPS. ISEP is definitely good, and I don't have as much experience. A lot of it is European, but I think, you know, ISEP is definitely, you know, has a presence here in the States, but I think the GUPS is kind of a very new, evolving, I mean, literally just within a couple of years, fellowship that's, I'm sorry, not fellowship, society that's quite active. But I think there are several books that are, without sort of isolating, so I have some colleagues and friends and they're involved in, you know, in chapters and books, but there's not probably not a specific one off the top of my head. You know, it's hard to, I think there's, you know, the Amherst series, you know, there's a couple good series out there, especially, you know, I'm blanking on the name now, but I know the Jared's book, the Derm Path one, the, you know, Derm
Survival Guides.
Yeah, survival guides. I think that they're. I think the prostate one, actually, I know that one's already out by Dr. Epstein and Andres Mosoa did that one as well. But yeah, I think those sort of as a primer, those are probably pretty good. Some online resources, even to be honest with you, even Pathology Outlines is actually really good, just to kind of go through the, you know, very basic. There's a lot actually in just basic Robins. You'd be surprised how much, you know, very good general path. And I think people just kind of blow it off, and it's like, if you, you know, master that. And then obviously, you know, I started out with Twitter, you know, kind of a social media kind of plug here, but I do not have Facebook, you know, LinkedIn, I don't have any other sort of things. And I sort of started out with, you know, I just want to kind of do this to learn path. And obviously I was like, I'm not going to post anything. I'm not going to, no funny stuff and, you know, nothing like that. It's just going to be, you know, I'm just going to review cases. But then I had so much stuff on my own, and you know, the number of cases you get to see, you know, in a book, I've seen like, you know, maybe one, two, and you know, people are posting, especially a lot of infectious stuff and unusual stuff, you know, around the country and around the nation, around the world, really, that you really don't even get to, you know, kind of think about, just, you know, over that repetitive nature. And there's sort of high, you know, almost like you feel like you need a CME. Somebody posted, and for Tristan, I know, who I also follow and love, is I feel like you need CME after reviewing one of his, you know, two tutorials. You deserve it. And I think that's, if you're just, you know, you're sitting at the airport or you're waiting for coffee in line, you know, before they call your name, you could probably, you know, just flip through and, you know, see a couple of interesting cases. So you don't have to filter with, there's a lot of junk. A lot of people like to post funny stuff out there, like myself sometimes, but, no, I think there's a lot of good stuff out there. So I think I wouldn't use that as your primary source. I think you probably need a backbone. And I think it could be potentially dangerous, because a lot of times people will post, hey, there's an example of something such and such. And it's like, no, that's not, you know, endometrial cancer. That's just secretory phase endometrial. And I've seen several of those already. So there to be a little bit careful and maybe follow reliable sources. But I think little bursts, you can get quite a lot of information through that. But I think, you know, really following, you know, some of the major journals, you know, obviously online, you know, the people always say like books are kind of a dying breed. And I would kind of disagree. I think if, at least in the beginning to start out, it's probably good to have a good foundation. And then as you sort of progress, you probably can rely more on, you know, courses. I think, you know, the ASCP, CAP, OSCAP, obviously attending the OSCAP can be quite cutting edge, especially the platforms and things like that. If you're an entry level, that might be a little bit, you know, overwhelming. But I think ASCP, CAP have some really good classes, courses. Many are actually posted online free, or at least discounted.
Yeah. Wow. So since we mentioned Twitter, just a little question. I've seen that your meme game is very strong. So where does that come from?
So I mean, to me, you know, I always have, I mean, I think we're sort of in a kind of a morbid field, right? In pathology, everything's cancer and sort of bleak. And so my goal is obviously to, you know, you never want to sort of, you know, objectify patients who are like, and people do get upset, like this is a beautiful or gorgeous kind of tumor. And, you know, people post that, you know, like you're upset about that. And I think, you know, you have to be, you know, how you spin cases and things like that and discuss it, and that's fine. But I think, you know, I think there's, It for me, the only way to kind of, you see all this, you know, cancer, neoplasia, and all this kind of, you know, negativity. There's rarely do you, I mean, we see some obviously not cancer benign entities. But I think, you know, I always try to spin, even amongst, you know, we do a daily consensus conference. I do the same jokes and everything, and maybe not the same ones, but necessarily, but you know, same, you know, I think life is too short to kind of be taken this seriously, and especially in a field as weak as ours. I think you sort of have to take, you know, take the laughter and there's a lot of people, a lot of images that I sort of see that I'm able to kind of spin, and like that's my favorite thing to do. And so I sort of save those images to the side and try not to post them all in one day, but you know, apply it in a specific pathology, because I think we see a lot of the way we view the world and the way we view things on a kind of daily basis. Even somebody in ClinPath is going to be like, and people have asked me like, what does that mean? I don't really understand. Like, well, that's a heavy AP kind of thing, and vice versa, I may not understand some of the things that are like, you know, deep AP. Or high level, you know, bench research things that, you know, jokes and memes and things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's the side of the way I like sort of make it applicable to our own field and kind of, you know, something that's out there and how maybe view it in a different way.
Yeah. Wow. That's wonderful. Just one last question. And since I guess I am allowed to say that you'll be joining academia soon.
Yes.
So how did you make that decision? I know you have been inclined towards research since, or you wanted to do research and have done research since you were a resident and you were in private practice and then you were going to academia. So what was that tipping point when you decided to go either way?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So, you know, it's sort of kind of, I just did a resident and fellow kind of teaching thing, a podium, you know, platform thing I've done for the folks at Stanford and UCSF as well, just kind of teaching them or, you know, hey, you know, Q&A sessions essentially for the folks in private practice. But it's a hard decision. I mean, coming out, I know that's not exactly your question, but I just kind of going back a little bit that it's, you know, which sort of alley, you know, do you kind of choose? I think attending these kinds of platforms and you know, Q&A sessions, talking with people that are actually in community practice. And then when you're on doing the consult service, you know, you obviously will see the same repetitive names and maybe in the meetings and going to these local societies, talking and sitting with people and really kind of getting a sense. There are some places that are probably actually even kind of let you shadow them for maybe half a day or something like that. I did that here, actually. There was a pathologist here that, you know, on the weekends I would come and review some cases with him. So, you know, I kind of got a sense like, oh, that, wow, private practice is not, you know, there's a sort of a running joke. You know, I don't know if you've heard this before, that, you know, the best place to hide a dollar bill for a community pathologist is to hide it in a journal. You know? And I think that's, you know, that's, I don't know if you've heard that before, but, you know, that was the impression that I all had running through, you know, in residency, like, oh, you know, they're not up to date with kind of stuff. And I think that's totally wrong. It depends on, obviously, the group. So I think kind of, you know, really meeting with the group and deciding, but the research aspect. So I think being cutting edge, I think there are some awesome community. I mean, there's people on Twitter that are just amazing that are in community practice as well. But I think the research side, my group has been pretty flexible. As long as I get my work done, financing it can be a little tough. Sometimes you have to partner with collaborators or vendors or whatnot. But if you really have kind of a diehard, like, you know, I just can't give up writing, then that's the kind of thing that, you know, the residence teaching, I think you can do that. Obviously on online, you can do that. And even just, you know, if you're active enough and good enough, you're local, whether you stay local for where you trained or your local academics, there will probably be more than happy to have you, you know, come and do these QA sessions in residence, because honestly, faculty are quite busy, nowadays at the academy. So they'd probably love that. But the writing part, if you're really kind of die hard, like I just can't, for me, I could never give up writing. The rush I get for, you know, I blast my, you know, orchestra music. And, you know, for me, it's, you know, I'm a big EDM fan during the day while I'm signing out cases. But when I have my, you know, my Bach and my other, you know, orchestra things on here, for me, that's my sit down and just writing. That's something I could never give up. So I think that's really hard to do in private practice. So if you really feel like you can't give that up, you have just a real strong interest in publication, then you kind of have your answer right there that you're probably leaning more towards academia. Can you make the jump afterwards? Yes, you can. It is harder, I would say, to go, especially if you're staying academic and then later go to private, because I think private, unless you're in a huge group where you're only doing one or two subspecialties, you pretty much are doing everything. So that's a tough thing to kind of relearn. You can, the farther out you are from training, I think it gets a little challenging. But if you're in private practice, and like myself, for example, like I'll be joining Stanford in the spring of next year. I've maintained my GU all the way throughout. And like I said, you know, with research, and I'm doing heavy volumes of GU now anyway. So it should be an easy transition, and I'll be doing only GU there. So it's actually going to be, you know, I've actually become a better pathologist now, having done, you know, general search path, surgical for 10 plus years here. But going that route, I think, is a little easier. If you're staying academics and then coming back into private, it can be a little tough because you're not used to seeing everything, depending on which group you're in. It can be done. But the one thing, you know, obviously there's pros and cons. You could probably do a whole separate session, 30-minute session, you know, pros and cons of of academia versus private and whatnot. Mm. But, you know, there are differences, you know, in pay and flexibility and structure. But even just using pay, for example, you know, everything is basically like there's two sides to it. I think, you know, I think in general, it's quite unfortunate that there's such a huge pay discrepancy between private and academic. So I think a lot of folks sort of shy away from academia because like, oh, you know, in private practice, you just don't, you know, you can make a lot more money, especially in the Bay Area. I'm just using an example of, or in a major city, like, you know, Chicago, New York, something like that. Like, how could you survive in community or in academia? I'm sorry. But then the flip side is you actually have, with the service weeks on time, you actually have a lot more off service time than you do here. Like here, I'm on service almost 44 weeks of the year. I'm done because, you know, we get, you know, a little bit of vacation, but I'm always on. I'm always signing out. Versus in academia, you actually, you know, you're not signing out as many weeks. You have some off time for obviously research. You could do biotech consulting. You could do medical legal work. So there's ways to supplement income. So again, that's something if you just, before you make a decision, really kind of think, don't just, it's not black and white, just like, oh, research. Well, you're talking about, you know, clinical research. You're talking about manuscripts, money. Are you talking about, you know, how does that compare to off service time? So I think there's always, you know, two sides to every coin.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think that's a very comprehensive view on that. Obviously, it's a much larger topic, and every private practice has its own quirks, and every academic group has its own quirks. I don't think we can cover that, even if we go on.
Absolutely.
Too long.
Yeah.
So, all right, thank you very much. That's our show for today, folks. You can find Dr. Sangoi on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @SLUSAGAR. And thank you very much for listening to us. If you like the show, please like and subscribe to our channels on YouTube and Apple. And we'll be back with another episode soon.
All right. Thanks, Abdul.
Special thank you to our listeners. Until next time, enjoy an excerpt from an upcoming interview with Dr. Anne Mills.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I always think about medicine in terms of these sort of spectrum between personalized and precision care and population preventative care. And I think they're equally important and equally satisfying. And I love that you get to do both. So like sitting on my desk right now, I have about 40 PAPs to read, and that is preventative medicine at its best, right? Those are tests that will hopefully help prevent these women from developing any invasive cervical neoplasias that at a different time in our history would have been the most common malignancies for women in our country, and are still the most common malignancies for women in other parts of the world. So I love that. That's super rewarding. And then next week I'll be on surgical pathology, and maybe I will see one of the unfortunate women who has, for whatever reasons, you know, barriers to access, developed an invasive cervical cancer. And I'll get to apply a PD-L1 stain to that and potentially give her, that individual, a very sophisticated option that may help her. So I think you can get these two kinds of satisfaction. One is the sort of like big, broad good, and then the other satisfaction is from the like individualized good that you can do. So I really find that to be very rewarding. I like the investigations you can do that hopefully help improve both of those kinds of efforts.